This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's now 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, April the 24th. Good to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Global warming is a moral issue, according to our guest this hour, in part because global warming is disproportionately created by the wealthy, and it is the poor that will bear the brunt of the consequences of global warming. We're going to talk about global warming this hour, but not as a scientific or political issue or debate, but as a matter of morality. This program was prompted by a listener suggestion, a listener who said that he hears from scientists and politicians on climate change and global warming issues on this program all the time and everywhere else for that matter. And he wanted to suggest a philosopher to talk about this, to talk about the ethics of global warming. Well, we are happy to oblige. This hour and today during Earth Week, we will talk with a professor of environmental studies and philosophy who says global warming is a moral issue and it will be difficult to act on climate change unless it is viewed as such. We welcome your thoughts and questions for him. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Toll free from anywhere. If you're in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. Talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Let me welcome our guest. Dale Jamieson is Director of Environmental Studies at New York University, where he is a Professor of Environmental Studies and Philosophy. He's also an affiliated professor of law. His most recent book is Morality's Progress, Essays on Humans, Other Animals, and the Rest of Nature. His chapter is the Moral and Political Challenges of Climate Change, which also appears in the published book Creating a Climate for Change, Communicating Climate Change, and Facilitating Social Change. He joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
I'm happy you could join us. Our listener has been very persistent in in suggesting that this is an important area for us to cover, because we don't hear much as global warming as an ethical issue or a moral issue. Why do you say it is?
Well, I think there are several areas where it raises moral challenges. The first area is really a very familiar one, but it's obscured by the scientific and technological complexities of the issue. And that question that it raises, or that issue, is really just the same old issue of the rich and powerful benefiting from an activity that harms the poor and powerless. When you really get to the bottom line of climate change, the rich countries and the rich people of the world have benefited. We've built our civilizations, our cultures, our standard of living, our way of life on emitting greenhouse gases. And those who will suffer most from this activity are going to be not just the poor people who are alive today, but their descendants out into the next century.
Why do you say they will suffer the most?
Well, it's a very familiar story. Poor people always suffer most from natural disasters and from extreme climatic events. It was interesting when we had Hurricane Katrina strike in the United States. There was this sense of surprise and outrage. People seemed to think that there was something unusual or weird about the idea that poor people and people of color would suffer most in a natural disaster. But that's the way of the world. That's how it goes. And that's just a very small taste of the 21st century world that we're entering.
Yeah. What about the rich that are emitting all these greenhouse gases are employing those poor and raising the standard of living by doing this?
Well, you know, of course, there is some of that. Every cloud has a silver lining, as we all learn from our parents, but clouds are still clouds, and silver linings are pretty thin.
Yeah. So you said that that was only one of the
right.
the questions. What else?
Well, the second issue, in a way, is more profound. Throughout most of human history, humans have really been vulnerable to nature. We've tried to claw our way around the world. We've tried to survive. We've tried to build our civilizations and cultures despite these enormous natural threats. But somewhere around 1950, the balance of power began to change and nature became vulnerable to us. And this idea that human activity, human technology, our way of life, can actually threaten the rest of non-human nature and indeed the very fundamental natural systems that really allowed us to evolve in the first place. So that raises, I think, very deep ethical issues about what the proper or appropriate human relationship to nature is.
Yeah. Why?
Why?
Yeah.
Well, because it's as old an issue as one can raise. I mean, are we here in some sense? Is the way that we thrive, the way that we survive, the way that we live a good life by living in some sense in harmony with our natural surroundings, or is it by domination?
Mm-hmm. Why do you say it is imperative to view global warming and climate change as a moral or ethical issue in order to act on any change?
Well, part of the problem with climate change is that it's the world's largest collective action problem. That is to say that for any individual, we have very little control over what's going to happen. So we're always open to the argument, well, you know, if I don't use my air conditioner, if I don't drive my car, someone else will. The atmosphere will still get loaded with greenhouse gases. Climate change will still happen. So what's the point of my doing anything? And each individual can think that way. Each country can think in that way. We're all trapped in this dilemma that makes it very difficult for us to get past it. And I think that's why when you look at the survey data, traditionally, at least for the last 10 years, people have been concerned about global warming, but it hasn't ranked very high on the issues that they see themselves as really wanting to address. And I think the only way you get out of that trap of powerlessness, of doesn't really matter what I do, is if you come to see the issue as really being one that's a moral challenge, that it matters in terms of your sense of self and what kind of person you want to be for you to really act on that issue. And I think if we as individuals and we as a society begin to see that issue in that way, that is really the only thing that's going to let us get beyond that sense of powerlessness that we tend to feel about that issue now.
Do you think we as a society are beginning to see it that way?
Well, I hope so. This is a moment in which that could happen. There have been several other such moments. 1988 was a moment, 1992 was a moment, and this is another one. I mean, I think it's heartening that an Academy Award winner has begun to frame this issue as a moral issue. For a very long time, former Vice President Gore actually resisted the moral framing of climate change. He instead framed it as a kind of technical issue, a kind of wonkish issue that could in some way be managed. And I think the fact that he's come out now in this way is, of course, very influential.
But, you know, we hear scientific panels saying the debate on what's causing global warming is over, but then we still hear opponents say, no, it isn't. So until we can resolve this political debate over the scientific facts, can we really act on these things? Can we really change things until that debate is settled?
Well, I think the first thing to recognize is that while there are many uncertainties about climate change, particularly about its regional effects, the basic debate is over. That is, the question, are humans changing global climate in a way that's going to have very severe negative impacts for many people and for non-human nature? There is a widespread scientific consensus about that. The reason that we tend not to be aware of that, I think, is because the media traditionally has dealt with this issue as a kind of, on the one hand, on the other hand kind of issue. And there are always people, a very small handful of people, but there are people out there who are climate change deniers, many of whom benefit from the extractive industries that stand to have to change their behavior and practices if we actually begin to address this issue. In this respect, it's not very different from the issue about smoking, in particular secondhand smoke. As long as you have powerful economic interests who feel that they will lose if we make the kinds of changes we need to make, then you'll always find a handful of people who are deniers about the science of the issue. But we shouldn't let that obscure the fact that there is a working consensus about climate change. It's expressed in the IPCC reports and other important studies.
So are climate change deniers immoral?
Well, I'm not the father confessor for these people.
Are they? Is that an unethical stance to say, I don't believe human activity is the cause of global warming, that this is, I think, a natural climatic cycle that the Earth goes through?
Well, I mean, this is what I think is the more important question. You know, there's always a range of beliefs that people have about all kinds of issues, and we don't think that people who have strange or weird or self-serving beliefs are always immoral. I mean, part of the problem here is that in some sense, if people are gaining economic benefits from having a certain set of beliefs, then, you know, all of us, it's human nature, you might say, come to find those beliefs a lot easier to accept than beliefs that challenge our way of life. I mean, I don't know. I mean, remember when the tobacco company executives were testifying before a congressional committee, and they all sat there and they all raised their hands. They all said that they didn't believe that smoking was addictive. Now, were those people just lying? Had they just managed to convince themselves that what they were saying was true? I don't know. I can't see into the human heart. I don't think that's what really matters. What matters is there is a working, robust, viable scientific consensus on this issue, and we need to get past this on the one hand, on the other hand, business, and really start talking about solutions and how to move on this issue.
We're talking with Dale Jamieson, Director of Environmental Studies at New York University, where he is a professor of environmental studies and philosophy, talking with us about the ethics of global warming. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We welcome your thoughts and questions for him. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you along. Hope you stay tuned for more talk about current issues of the day with Ben Marins this afternoon between 4 and 6. We're talking about the ethics of global warming with a guest who says it's important that we start looking at climate change as an ethical issue, a moral issue. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions for him. I'm going to start, Professor Jamieson, with an email from Steve in Oshkosh, because Steve in Oshkosh is the listener who suggested we do this topic and suggested you as a guest, for that matter. What do you think of the climate change solution that professor and philosopher Peter Singer has advocated, that we ought to institute a global system of trading emission quotas? And that was based on his view that pollution quotas ought to be tied to per capita emissions rather than total national emissions. I'm not sure if I follow that all, but you probably do.
Well, first let me explain something about the proposal, and then I'll tell you what I think about it. Well, first of all, I would say that most people who've been working on the climate change policy issue for very many years now have thought that some kind of emissions trading or cap, or what's called a cap and trade system, is really the best way to proceed with this issue. The idea is that you dole out some permissions to emit greenhouse gases either on a national basis or through companies and institutions. And then if particular companies or institutions want to emit more than they're allowed under this system, then they have to buy those permissions from someone who's willing to sell them in return for emitting less. Those kinds of systems have been used in other air quality issues, and they typically produce very effective results at relatively low cost. So they're very much in favor on the part of people who think about policy solutions. Now, what Singer suggested, and indeed in this respect he was following some proposals that I've made and other people before me have made, is that when we think about who has the rights to emit greenhouse gases, rather than thinking in terms of who's been doing the emitting or on the basis of countries, instead what we should think is that each person in the world should have a right to emit the same amount of greenhouse gases, whether they're Americans, whether they're from Bangladesh, whether they're from Saudi Arabia, wherever, it doesn't matter. And if Americans want to emit more than people in, say, Honduras, then Americans need to buy those permissions from those people. Because there's nothing about being an American, per se, that gives you a greater right to use the atmosphere, which is a global good, than anyone else. So that's the basic idea, and it's an idea that I support as well.
Yeah. So right now, countries like the U.S. and China and India are, I don't know, emitting more greenhouse gases than they should be if under this type of proposal?
Well, you know, it's interesting because China is so much in the news, and there's so much concern in the American press and among various opinion leaders about China and Chinese gas emissions that most of us, I think, have a false idea about how much China emits. Because China is a large country with a large population, if you look at it nationally, their emissions are second only to those of the United States. But in fact, the average American emits four times the amount of carbon as the average Chinese person. And indeed, for that matter, the residents of Egypt, Thailand, Argentina, Sweden, Ukraine, all emit more carbon on average than the average Chinese.
Yeah. How does this idea relate to what Al Gore says he does in order to, I don't know, have a big house and fly in a jet? He's doing some sort of trading thing.
Right. This is the idea of carbon offsets. And the idea here is that if you emit carbon, if you're responsible for emitting carbon, say by having a heated swimming pool or flying a lot around a lot in airplanes or driving a lot, then the idea is that if you, say, plant some trees or take those kinds of actions, pay for other people to plant trees, those trees will sop up the carbon. They'll absorb the carbon. And so that can neutralize the effect of your action. Now, that's a tricky business. It's a tricky business because, you know, in principle, it's a good idea. That is the way the atmosphere works, right? You can emit in one place, and it can be absorbed in another place. The problem we have is in trying first to quantify that. I mean, what exactly is the correct offset? How many trees do you have to plant to, you know, make up for taking an airplane to China, for example? And the second problem, of course, is that the natural system, I mean, that is to say, keeping that coal in the ground or keeping that oil in the ground is a much better way of keeping that coal or oil, that carbon out of the atmosphere than planting a tree or changing a farming practice. We don't really know what the long-term effect is going to be of that. Someone may come along and cut those trees down. There may be a forest fire. Who knows? The best thing to do with carbon is to leave it in the ground.
We'll go to the phones with full lines at the moment. Jim in Superior starts us off. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hello. I'm wondering if your guests would agree with me that people such as Al Gore, John Kerry, John Edwards, with their 3-4 huge houses that use up in 1 or 2 months the energy that the average person uses up in a whole year, would that be considered hypocrites? And one other thing about this carbon trading or whatever you call it. So in other words, only rich people can do that. The average Joe, I can't afford to go plant 100 trees. I wouldn't be, I wouldn't be able to do that.
Yeah. Well, these are both good questions. The first question about hypocrisy, I just want to say first that I don't want to go there in saying Al Gore is a hypocrite any more than I want to go there by saying, you know, climate change deniers don't really believe what they're saying. The issue isn't really one of personal hypocrisy. It's really what we're going to do as a country and as a world to try to address this issue. And I have to say that I think in general, we Americans tend to get too hung up on ideas of hypocrisy and moral purity. And that really can get in the way of our trying to reach solutions. Whatever is true of Al Gore's personal behavior, and again, I'm not his father confessor, and for that matter, neither is Jim in Superior, there's no doubt that he's articulated this issue and put it on the agenda in a way that people like me can only dream of. So I think we have to give him some credit for that. As for this other issue about, well, if we have a carbon trading system, only the rich, you know, are allowed to use carbon and so on. I really have two responses to that. One response is that there are ways of trying to address that problem. So let me just give you an example. A lot of us have advocated something we call a carbon tax. Carbon tax essentially puts a tax on everything that emits carbon into the atmosphere. Now, that sounds terrible, and it sounds, you know, like it's really going to hurt poor people. But that's only the case if the government keeps that tax revenue. So one thing you could do with the revenue that's raised by a carbon tax is you could give it back to people on the basis of the things they need. You could, for example, refund that money to poor people whose standards of living that you want to raise. So there are ways of trying to do a carbon tax, for example, or other climate change policies that won't just benefit the rich at the expense of the poor. But the second comment that I'd like to make is this. I and I think others who work in this area feel very sensitive to the problem of economic inequality in America. But it's not just a problem in trying to deal with climate change. We have a system, for example, where the kind of health care you get depends enormously on your economic status. So it's hardly anything that's particularly problematical about trying to deal with climate change, which, after all, will hurt the poor more than the rich, that we've got this deep, deep problem of social inequality in America that we need to address beyond and outside of this problem of climate change.
We're talking with Dale Jamieson. He's the director of environmental studies at New York University. He's also a professor of environmental studies and philosophy and an affiliated professor of law. Talking with him about the ethics of climate change, based on a listener suggestion, he has a chapter in a recently published book, Creating a Climate for Change, Communicating Climate Change and Facilitating Social Change. And our next caller is Trish in Wrightstown. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Professor Jamieson. Thank you so much for bringing this issue to us. I guess I'd like to address your philosophical professorship rather than the environmental sciences. We hear all the time about the how-tos of, you know, how to be environmentally sustainable, but my interest is in what motivates people, and my theory is that faith is a motivator. And I also would like you to comment on the polarization of the religious community right now on environmental issues.
Those are quite interesting questions that Trish raises.
First of all, maybe there is a polarization in the religious community on environmental issues?
Yes. Mm-hmm. There is a movement in the evangelical community to address this issue of climate change. Mm-hmm. Because there are people in this community, including people in leadership positions in this community, who actually see the idea of creation care as being one of the tenets of their religion. And people who have been advocating this position are under very severe pressure from other leadership elements in that community who have tended to follow a more predictable Republican or conservative or right-wing agenda. And it's not clear at all how that's going to come out. But I would just like to say that this is, of course, a country in which religious ideas and religious faith is very strong. And traditionally, people have not seen religious faith as being any sort of obstacle to being concerned about the environment or caring about the environment. And I think we're beginning to see a rebirth of that idea that, that in fact, if anything, the religious faith of most Americans would support a concern for nature rather than a concern for the polluters.
Yeah. What about faith as a big motivator of people?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, the great social movements in American history have largely been sustained by religious faith. The civil rights movement is, of course, the example that comes immediately to mind. I think it's very, very difficult to get a broad-based social movement going in America that's going to require people to change the way that they live if it's not sustained by faith and supported by people of faith. think that's true.
I wonder what you have to say to Scott in Green Bay, who sent us an email that, "I agree, climate change is a moral issue. However, the major causes of global warming are not individual choices, but rather the decisions in faraway boardrooms of corporations, which the public has absolutely no say."
Well, thank you for that, Scott, because one of the really ethical issues I did want to raise, the third area, is climate change raises the question of the relationship between our behavior as individuals and really questions of political morality. We can all try to reduce our consumption. We can all try to ride bicycles even through Wisconsin winters, which of course are not quite
as bad.
Some
of us can do that.
Which are not quite as bad as they used to be, of course. But we can do all of those things as individuals, and that's not really going to address the problem. We have to behave collectively, and we have to act politically, and we have to see those ethical values translated into political action. And that's beginning to happen. And it's happening mostly at the local level and at the state level. The towns and communities and mayors and states of America are way ahead of our national political leaders on this question. So I think Scott's point is a very important point, but it's not as though we as individuals are powerless. We live in a democracy, and we need to act democratically on this issue.
Do you have any thoughts on, just because it's in the news this morning and yesterday, about, I guess they were acting politically as individuals and trying to motivate more, Sheryl Crow and Lori Davidson approaching Karl Rove at that dinner on Saturday night, asking him about that he should change his mind or change his approach on climate change?
Well, to tell you the truth, I think they were doing him a favor. If you look at the Bush administration's poll numbers, for example, it's hard to believe the president is getting good advice to stay the course, to be inflexible, to not change his policies, to not be open to these issues that clearly the American people care about. This is not really serving his interests in terms of a legacy. And so in that regard, I think anyone who's trying to just have a conversation with the people in the White House and say, look, it's in your own political interests for you to actually show some responsiveness on this issue is actually doing them a favor. So I think it was another sad comment, I have to say, on the present administration, that this is just another area where at least the political advisors seem so unreceptive to advice.
We'll go now to Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning. It's funny that your guest is speaking about ethics because, you know, this, first of all, the issue of global warming has not been resolved. He knows that. There are scientists all over the country, all over the world, who are now popping up with alternative theories. Yes, the climate is warming, but they are not convinced it's due to humans. And in fact, we know it's cyclical. In fact, a lot of scientists, particularly meteorologists, will tell you that if you look at the historic nature of temperatures, it goes up and down. The second thing is, this is really more about a new movement to control people's lives. This professor and Al Gore, the reason he doesn't want to criticize Al Gore is because Al Gore is along the same lines. He wants to tell other people how to live, but he will not live that way himself. This is an example of environmental fascism. This is about controlling people. If this professor thinks
Mike. You're trying to control everyone else's life, Dale Jameson?
Well, no. In fact, I'm doing my best to control my own life, primarily. Mike certainly has a right to his opinion about what may be the political agendas at work on various sides of the issue. I don't know what Al Gore's political agenda is any more than I know what George Bush's political agenda is in all of its detail. But what I do want to comment on is his misrepresentation of the science. What he says is just false about this. We have a very, very robust body of international science that's represented in the reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that firmly come to a very strong conclusion that the climate is changing due to human influence. And I have to say that I am getting really tired of people who just simply say things about the state of the science that's false and wrong and misleading. We can argue all about the politics. We can argue all about the policy. But really, let's try to live in a fact-based world in discussing this issue.
Our guest is Dale Jamieson. He is Director of Environmental Studies at New York University, where he is a professor of environmental studies and philosophy. He's also an affiliated professor of law. His most recent book is Morality's Progress: Essays on Humans, Other Animals, and the Rest of Nature. He has a chapter called The Moral and Political Challenges of Climate Change, which is in the recently published book Creating a Climate for Change. We're talking with him about the ethics of climate change and how he believes we should view climate change and global warming as an ethical or moral issue. And we welcome your thoughts and questions for him. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn is with you talking with the superintendent of Milwaukee Public Schools about the board-approved use of plastic handcuffs on students. And in the second half of the hour, another guest saying handcuffs are not the answer. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking about the ethics of climate change and looking at global warming as a moral issue. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Cater in Glenflora is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I'm part of a nonprofit in northern Wisconsin that's trying to do exactly the kind of things you're talking about, basically raise people's awareness about the effects of their lives on all kinds of things in the world, not just climate change, and then to go beyond that and try and support them in finding some kind of realistic, sustainable change they can make in their life. And what we've come to is that we see it's not only important to raise their or heighten their awareness about the importance of these issues, as you've been talking about, but at the other end of the effort to show them that it doesn't have to be a major life overhaul for them, that they can find something that's simple, that fits into their system of values and their social group that they live in, that will work for them. So in other words, to try and, on the one hand, increase the motivation, as you're talking about, the importance of these issues, and at the other hand, make it easier, find ways to fit into their philosophy. Just like your last caller, we find that if you just stress the moral significance or the importance of it, it's easy to polarize the issue. But if you try and understand that person's life and find a change that works for them, then you're much less likely to make them defensive or polarized. So this is the kind of strategy that we've been working towards, and it's really been effective in getting people to do this in their own life, to take the initiative, and then to go on to help other people do it.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Jamieson?
Yes, well, I think Cater's remarks are very good, and I think we do need to work it in all of these different ways. I think just two other points I would like to make. The first point is that, you know, not all Americans emit huge amounts of greenhouse gases. There's actually great disparities in the amount that we emit, depending on how large our houses are, mm-hmm. what kinds of cars we drive, even what part of the country that we live in. For example, people in Wisconsin, on a per capita basis, emit about 1/7 the greenhouse gases of people in our vice president's home state, namely the state of Wyoming. And we in New York emit even less greenhouse gases per capita than you in Wisconsin.
Oh, that kind of baffles me. Why would that be?
Well, it has to do with, I think, two things in this case. One thing it has to do is simply the way of life, the way communities are organized. Mm-hmm. But it also, of course, has to do with the extractive industries being so important in Wyoming. The economy of Wyoming, this isn't really news to anyone, does not have a sustainable economy. Mm-hmm. It's based on extractive industries. So it's important to recognize that even in this country, there are all kinds of different ways of life with very, very different environmental impacts. And now, having said that, it is inevitable that we are going to have to change. The era of carbon, or at least of oil, is coming to an end. And indeed, although we have lots and lots and lots of coal, and we could burn it all, if we were to burn all of the coal that is available, we would transform the world in ways that climate scientists are even just beginning to understand because it's so far out on the extreme. So it's just inevitable that we're going to change, and the question is whether we're going to change positively, optimistically, view this change as an opportunity, or whether we're going to go into the future fighting this rear guard action, trying to defend the 19th century way of life against a new world.
I've got an email from Mark in Maguanago who says, one issue seldom discussed is where will people get chemicals in the long term? Most of all the chemicals used to make drugs, plastics, and other things used are derived from oil. When we burn all the oil, where will people 400 years from now get these materials, including medicines? Save the oil for those things that it is needed for, and don't burn it all now. You want to comment on that?
Well, I think that's it's a good idea that Mark has, in the sense that we're using these natural resources in ways that are really silly in many respects and will look silly to future generations. So if you just think about it, for example, if I want to go to Walmart and buy something, in order to transport myself to this place, I happen to take along a several-ton vehicle with me, and it takes all of that energy, and I have to burn all that oil to get not just me there, but to also get this several-ton vehicle. It's a silly use of oil, which is a very precious resource. At the same time, I think it's important to remember that if we change the incentives, if we get these markets right and we get them working in the way that we should, if people start paying for harms that they're inflicting on the environment by using greenhouse gases, if they start getting benefits for environmentally friendly activities that they do as they begin to move away from carbon into more sustainable ways of life, markets have ways of finding solutions and finding substitutes and finding new commodities to use. So I feel very optimistic about the future, so long as we stop rewarding people for environmentally destructive activities and instead start rewarding them for doing the kinds of things we're going to need to do to make the world sustainable.
Todd in Deer Park is with us now. Hi, Todd.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I just can't get my arms around the fact that at one point, Wisconsin was covered by a glacier before there were any people around or any internal combustion engines, and they all receded, which means that the climate warmed. How can this latest half a percent or half a degree rise in temperatures be attributed to people when obviously it's happened before? I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Right. Well, this is something I do think some people get a little confused about. It's certainly true that the Earth changes. It is an intrinsic fact about the planet and planetary systems that they change according to all kinds of internal dynamics. When people talk about a human-caused climate change, no one is saying that all changes are caused by humans or that the only changes are caused by humans. Essentially, what we're saying is that in addition to these natural cycles, there is now a very strong and very clear, very dramatic human influence that is being added to these natural changes and natural cycles. And indeed, the human influence is very strong and very rapid. And in part, it's because it's layered on top of natural cycles that makes it in some ways even riskier and even potentially more threatening.
Thank you very much, Todd. Mark in Kenosha, hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, Mark from Kenosha calling. I was struck by another show I saw and listened to the other day about a disinformation campaign by Big Tobacco in the mid-60s. Instead of challenging science, using science as a tool to suggest that there were alternate explanations for cancer tobacco link. Flash forward to the present, and it seems that the efforts of people like the environmental scientist, what's that guy's name, Bjorn Lomborg, seemed to strike me in a similar vein. I was wondering if you had any comments on that.
Well, yes. I mean, I do think that there's all kinds of similarities and analogies between these campaigns. And, of course, again, the reasons are obvious. There are large corporate interests that see themselves as losers if we begin to address these issues, and so they resist the change. And, you know, there's even been work that's been done by Ross Gelbspan and by George Monbiot, who's a British investigative reporter, who have actually claimed to have shown that, in fact, even some of the same people in companies and institutions are involved in funding deniers in the case of climate change, who were involved in funding deniers in the case of secondhand tobacco smoke and its effects.
Our guest is Dale Jamieson. We're talking with him about the ethics of climate change and how he says we should be viewing global warming as a moral issue. And we welcome your questions for him. We have a few more minutes left in the program, and our lines are open now. They've been busy pretty much all hour, but an open line for you now at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Do you view climate change as an ethical issue, or changing your own habits, perhaps, as an ethical issue when it comes to global warming? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And, of course, now our lines are full. But, Professor Jamieson, for those who do view this as an ethical or moral issue and are very concerned about the impact we are having on future generations and the poor in particular, as you pointed out at the top of the hour, or the impact that we are having on nature and destroying the environment and nature, as you also explained at the top of the hour, what do we do?
Well, I think there's a number of things that we can do. Of course, changing some of our own habits is a good way to start. But I also think extending from changing our own habits to supporting politicians and political leaders who want to do something about this issue. There's a lot that's going on now at the state and local level. I live in New York. Our mayor yesterday gave a speech in which he gave a picture, a vision of a sustainable New York City, which involves, among other things, what's known as congestion pricing, which will charge automobiles for coming into the center core of the city. That's a very effective policy that's been used in places like London and Stockholm for reducing the use of automobiles. And in this case, a lot of the use of automobiles is to just sit there and idle and go at 5 miles an hour. Highly polluting activity doesn't benefit anyone. So there's a lot of things that are keyed, I think, to local initiatives and local activities. Universities and colleges around the country are committing themselves to carbon neutrality. My university, NYU, just made a major purchase of wind energy to replace the energy that we get off the grid that's produced by coal-fired generating plants. A lot can be done just by working in those institutions in which we work, in which we live, in our churches and our communities.
We'll go to Donna in Menominee. Hi, Donna. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a little concerned about what a lot of environmentalists say, that makes it sound like we're just going to have to sort of tweak our lifestyles a little bit, do a little bit more conservation, make a little bit of a switch from coal fire to something else. And it seems to me that we're going to have to make truly radical changes, and in a fairly short time frame. And I'd just like a comment on that, though. What do you think?
Well, no, I think you're right. I think that the kind of change that's going to be required to respond to this problem is probably the most profound intentional change that humanity has ever undertaken. I think it's important to recognize that change does not mean deterioration or everything heading south. Change can be good and change can be positive. And if we're not, as I was saying before, willing to make those changes, nature has a way of making them for us. And in any case, it's really the future of our children and their children that's at stake. And do we really want to be the sort of people who were hanging on to the shred of a certain way of life that in 100 years is going to be seen as incredibly self-indulgent and incredibly destructive to the environment in a way that we saw as benefiting ourselves, even though we sacrificed our children's future for it? I don't think that's how any of us want to be remembered.
Yeah, we also hear it's too late.
Yeah.
Is it?
Well, no, it's not too late to do something. Of course, the sooner we act, the more effectively we can hope to try to deal with this problem. We are going to have to adapt to climate change. It's too late to prevent it. That's true. But this message that it's too late to act is often a message you hear from the same people who sunk their heels in and for a long time said, it's not a problem, it's not a problem. And now then very quickly switch to saying, and it's too late to do anything about it. They're both strategies for trying to get us to do nothing. And, you know, it's the old story of a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. We are at a moment when we can take a number of very important steps forward, and there's no time to act like present.
Rick in Janesville is with us now. Hi, Rick.
Yeah, good morning. I just had a couple of comments to make. There's an elephant in the room that nobody seems to want to deal with, and that's world population.
I'm sorry, global what population?
Global population.
Okay, all right.
The other comment is our capitalist economic system is based entirely on unlimited growth. And until that changes, I don't see any way that we can actually deal with climate change.
Okay. First, about global population, I agree with Rick. That is a serious problem. When we think about population, though, we always have to think of it as coupled with consumption. We can support a lot of people who are consuming very little or relatively few people who are consuming a lot. The world cannot support many people who consume like Americans, and the problem with China that often gets mentioned is not just a problem with the number of Chinese people. It's a problem with the number of Chinese people who aspire to live something like American lifestyles. That's the problem. And here I'll only mention that this administration, which has been so much in denial about climate change, has also been in denial about population problems, that this President Bush, unlike his father, has not taken this issue seriously. So we're talking about the same elephant minders, if you will, in the same part of the room. As far as growth goes, you know, we can have growth in a lot of different ways. And the American economy in recent years has grown primarily in the service sector anyway. And the service sector has much less environmental impact, if it's managed correctly, than some other sectors of the economy. So I think we can have growth, and we can also move towards a greener future.
Yeah, well, we're a good place to leave it. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dale Jamieson, Director of Environmental Studies at New York University, a professor of environmental studies and philosophy, and an affiliated professor of law. His most recent book is Morality's Progress, Essays on Humans, Other Animals, and the Rest of Nature. We were talking with him about the ethics of climate change, and he has a chapter called The Moral and Political Challenges of Climate Change in the new book, Creating a Climate for Change. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.